about where we left off.
I'm not sure what that means.
All right. Let's start with this. I assume you went through with the wedding.
He must have guessed, because she'd never contacted him. But there was no sadness or bitterness in his tone. Only curiosity.
I did, she admitted.
Josh and I got married, but
she wasn't ready to delve into details.
We didn't make it. We divorced 8 years ago.
He glanced down at the sand, then back up again.
That must have been difficult for you. I'm sorry.
Don't be, she said.
The marriage had run its course, and it was time to end it.
How about you? Did you ever get married again?
No,
he answered.
Things never quite worked out that way.
It's just me these days.
Though it was selfish of her, she felt a wave of relief.
You still have Andrew, right? He must be in his 30s by now.
He's 34,
True answered.
I see him a few times a year. He lives in Antwerp these days.
Is he married?
Yes,
True said.
3 years.
Amazing, she thought. It was difficult to imagine. Does he have children yet?
His wife, Annette, is pregnant with their first.
So you'll be a grandfather soon.
I suppose I will be,
he admitted.
How about you? Did you ever have the children you wanted?
Two, she nodded. A boy and a girl.
Well, actually, I suppose they're a man and woman now.
They're in their 20s, Jacob and Rachel.
He squeezed her hand gently.
I'm happy for you.
Thank you. It's been the thing I'm most proud of, she said. Do you still guide?
No,
he answered.
I retired 3 years ago.
Do you miss it?
Not at all,
he said.
I've grown to enjoy sleeping past dawn without wondering whether lions will be at my doorstep.
She knew it was small talk, skimming the surface of things, but it felt unforced and easy, like the conversations she had with her closest friends. They could go months, sometimes a year, without speaking, then pick up exactly where they'd left off the last time they'd spoken. She hadn't imagined it would be the same with True, but the pleasant realization was interrupted by an arctic blast of wind. It cut through her jacket and kicked up the sand on the dunes. Over his shoulder, she saw her scarf shift on the bench while the letters beneath fluttered at the edges.
Hold on, I'd better put the letters back before they blow away.
She hurried to the mailbox. While her legs had felt like jelly when she'd arrived, they now felt rejuvenated, as if time were moving backward. Which, in a way, it was. Closing the mouth of the mailbox, she noticed that True had followed her.
I'm going to keep the letter you wrote me, she told him. Unless you don't want me to.
Why wouldn't I? I wrote it for you.
She wrapped the scarf around her neck.
Why didn't you mention in the letter that you were still here? You could have simply written, wait for me.
I wasn't exactly sure how long I was going to stay in the area. When I wrote to you, I didn't know the date that you would be here, and the original letter you wrote was no longer in the mailbox when I arrived.
She tilted her head. How long were you thinking you'd stay?
Through the end of the year.
At first, not sure she'd heard him right, she couldn't respond. Then, you were planning to come here every day until January? And then go back to Africa?
You're half correct. I was planning to stay through January, but no, even then, I wasn't going to return to Africa. Not immediately, anyway.
Where were you planning to go?
I intended to stay here in the States.
Why?
He seemed puzzled by the question.
So I could look for you,
he finally answered.
She opened her mouth, trying to respond, but again, no words would come.
It made no sense at all, she thought. She didn't deserve this devotion. She'd left him. She'd seen him break down and continued to drive away. She'd chosen to destroy his hopes and make a life with Josh instead. And yet, as he gazed at her, she realized that his love remained undimmed, even if he hadn't yet grasped how much she'd missed him, or how much she still cared for him now. In her mind, she heard a voice warning her to be careful, to be completely honest about everything, so he wouldn't be hurt again. But in the throes of their reunion, the voice seemed distant, an echo that faded away to a whisper. "What are you doing this afternoon?" she asked.
"Nothing. What did you have in mind?"
Instead of answering, she smiled, knowing exactly where to go. They started back the way they'd come, eventually reaching the sand gully that separated Bird Island from Sunset Beach. In the distance, they could see the outline of the pier, its details lost in the glare off the water. The waves were long and gentle, rolling toward the shore in steady rhythm. Up ahead, Hope noted that there were more people on the beach now, tiny figures moving along the water's edge. The air was sharp, carrying with it the scent of pine and wind, and in the chill she felt her fingers beginning to tingle. They moved at a leisurely pace, though True didn't seem to mind. She caught the hint of a limp in his stride, noticeable enough to make her wonder what had happened to him. It might be nothing, perhaps a touch of arthritis or simply the byproduct of an active life, but it reminded her that despite their shared history, they were in many ways strangers. She'd cherished a memory, but that wasn't necessarily the man he was today. Or was it? Walking beside him, she wasn't sure. All she knew was that being with him felt as easy and comforting as it had back then. And glancing over at True, she suspected he felt the same way. Like her, he'd tucked his hands into his pockets, his cheeks turning pink in the chill, and there was a contented air about him, like a man just returned home after a long journey. Because the tide was slowly coming in, they walked at the very edge of the hard-packed sand, both of them watching for waves that might soak their shoes. They drifted into conversation, the words flowing unchecked, like an old habit rediscovered. She did most of the talking. She told him about the deaths of her parents, touched briefly on work, along with her marriage and subsequent divorce from Josh, but mainly found herself telling him about Jacob and Rachel. She told countless stories about their childhoods and their teen years, and admitted how terrified she'd been when Rachel had her open heart surgery. Often she read reactions of warmth or concern on True's face, his empathy plain. She couldn't recall everything, of course. Some of the details of her life were lost to her, but she felt that True instinctively grasped the patterns and threads of her past. By the time they'd passed beneath the pier, she suspected there was little about her life as a mother that he didn't already know. As they moved through the softer sand and began to angle toward the path that led through the dunes, she walked ahead of him, realizing that unlike the arduous hike out to Kindred Spirit, she'd barely noticed the trek back. Her fingers felt warm and supple in her pockets, and despite doing almost all of the talking, she wasn't winded. After skirting the path, they reached the street, and she noticed a car parked in the spot next to hers. "Yours?" she asked, pointing. "A rental," he said. It made sense that he'd rented a car, she supposed, but she couldn't help but realize that their cars were close to each other, as if drawn together by the same magical forces that had allowed Hope and True to reunite. She found that oddly touching. "How about you follow me?" she offered. "It's a bit of a drive."
"Lead the way."
She hit the button to unlock the doors and slipped behind the wheel. The car was cold, and after starting the engine, she cranked the heater to maximum. Beyond the glass, True got into his rental. She backed out, then stopped in the street to wait for him. When he was ready, she removed her foot from the brake, and the car began to roll forward, toward an afternoon she couldn't have foreseen, and a future she couldn't imagine. Alone in the car, her thoughts began to wander, and she continued to peek in the rearview mirror, making sure True didn't disappear, making sure she hadn't been hallucinating, because part of her still couldn't believe that he'd learned of her letter. But he had learned of it, she thought. He was here. He'd come back because she'd wanted him to, and he still cared for her. She took a breath, steadying herself as the car finally began to warm. His car trailed behind hers through the turns and over the bridge, onto the highway where, thankfully, most of the lights were green, then finally toward the turnoff that led to Carolina Beach. Another small bridge and a few turns later, she pulled into the driveway of the cottage she'd rented. She left room for True to pull in alongside her, watching as he finally came to a stop. She stepped out, listening to the ticking of her engine as it cooled. In his car, True was turned around, reaching for something in the back seat, his hair silver through the glass. As she waited, thin strands of clouds drifted overhead, softening the glare. The breeze was steady, and after the warmth of the car, she felt herself suddenly shiver. As she crossed her arms, she heard a cardinal call from the trees, and when she spotted it, she flashed to the memory of Joe's letter to Lena that True had read to her when they'd visited Kindred Spirit long ago. Cardinals, she thought, mate for life. The idea made her smile. True stepped out of the car, moving as gracefully as he had in the past. Holding a canvas bag in his hand, he squinted toward the cottage.
Is this where you're staying?
I rented it for a week. He scrutinized the cottage again, then turned back to her.
It reminds me of your parents' cottage.
She smiled, feeling a sense of deja vu. That's exactly what I thought when I first saw it, too. The autumn sun slanted down on them as True followed her to the front door. Once inside, Hope set her hat, gloves, and scarf on the end table and hung her jacket in the closet. True hung his jacket beside hers. The canvas bag went onto the end table next to her things. There was something reassuringly domestic about the ease with which they entered the house, she thought. As if they'd been doing it together all their lives. She could feel a draft coming through the windows. Though she'd adjusted the thermostat earlier, the house was struggling against the elements, and she rubbed her arms to keep the blood flowing. She watched as True took in the surroundings, and she had the sense that his eyes still missed nothing.
I can't believe you're really here, she said. I never thought in a million years you'd come.
And yet, you were waiting for me at the mailbox.
She acknowledged his observation with a sheepish smile, combing her fingers through her wind-blown hair.
I've done most of the talking, so now I want to hear about you.
My life hasn't been all that interesting.
So you say,
she said, her expression skeptical. She touched his arm. Are you hungry? Can I make you some lunch?
Only if you'll join me. I had a late breakfast, so I'm not famished.
Then how about a glass of wine? I think this calls for a little celebration.
I agree,
he said.
Do you need help?
No, but if you wouldn't mind getting the fire going, that would be great. Just flip the switch near the mantel, it's automatic, and then make yourself at home. I'll be back in a minute.
Hope went to the kitchen and peered into the refrigerator. Pulling out the bottle of wine, she poured two glasses and returned to the living room. By then, the fire was going and True was on the couch. After handing him a glass, she set hers on the coffee table.
Do you need a blanket? Even with a fire going, I'm still kind of chilled.
I'm all right, he said.
She gathered up a throw from the bed in her room, then took a seat on the couch, adjusting the blanket over herself before reaching for her glass. The heat from the fireplace was already seeping into the room.
This is nice, she commented, thinking he was as handsome as when they'd first met. Wildly unbelievable, but nice.
He laughed, a familiar rumble.
It's more than nice. It's miraculous.
Lifting his glass, he said,
to Kindred Spirit.
After clinking glasses, they both took a sip. When True lowered his glass, he gave a faint smile.
I'm surprised that you're not staying at Sunset Beach.
It's not the same, she said. Nor has it been since I met you, she added silently.
Have you been here before?
She nodded,
I came here the first time after I separated from Josh. She told him a bit about what she'd been going through back then, and how much the visit had helped her clear her mind, before going on. At the time, it was all I could do to keep a lid on all the emotions I was experiencing. But the time alone also reminded me how much the kids were struggling with a divorce, too, even if they weren't showing it. They really needed me, and it helped me refocus on that.
You sound like you were a great mother.
I tried, she shrugged. But I made mistakes, too.
I think that's part of the description, at least when it comes to being a parent. I still wonder whether I should have spent more time with Andrew.
Has he said anything?
No, but he wouldn't. And yet the years went by too quickly. One day, he was a little boy, and the next thing I knew, he was heading off to Oxford.
Did you stay at Hwange until then?
I did.
But then you left.
How did you know that?
I looked for you, she said. Before putting the letter in the mailbox, I mean.
When?
In 2006. After I divorced from Josh, probably a year after my first visit to Carolina Beach. I remembered where you worked, and I contacted the lodge. Other places, too, but I couldn't find you. He seemed to contemplate that, his eyes unfocused for a few seconds. She had the sense there was something he wanted to say but couldn't. Instead, after a few beats, he offered a gentle smile.
I wish I had known,
he said finally.
And I wish you would have.
Me too, she thought. What happened? I thought you liked working at Hwange.
I did,
he said.
But I was there for a long time, and it was time to move on.
Why?
There was new management at the camp, and a lot of the other guides had left, including my friend Romy. He'd retired a couple of years earlier. The lodge was going through a transition period, and with Andrew off to college, there was really nothing to keep me in the area. I thought that if I wanted to start over someplace else, it was better sooner rather than later. So I sold my place in Bulawayo and moved to Botswana. I'd found a job at a camp that sounded interesting.
So he went to Botswana after all, she thought. They all sound interesting to me.
A good number of them actually are,
he agreed.
Did you ever get to go on safari? You had said that you wanted to one day.
Not yet. I'm still hoping to, though. Then, circling back to what he'd said earlier, and remembering how many camps she'd contacted, she asked, What was so interesting about the camp in Botswana? Was it well known?
Not at all. It's more of a middle-tier camp. The accommodations are a bit rustic. Bagged lunches instead of prepared meals, things like that. And the game can be fairly sporadic. But I'd heard about the lions in the area, or rather, a specific pride of them.
I thought you saw lions all the time.
I did, he said, but not like this. I'd heard a rumor that the lions had learned to hunt and bring down elephants.
How could lions bring down an elephant?
I had no idea, and I didn't believe it at the time. But eventually I met a guide who used to work there. He told me that while he hadn't actually seen an attack, he'd come across an elephant carcass the following day, and it was clear to him that lions had been feasting most of the night.
She squinted at him doubtfully. Maybe the elephant was sick, and the lions came across it?
That's what I thought initially. People always talk about the lion as being the king of the jungle. Even that Disney movie, The Lion King, played up the mythology. But I knew from experience that it wasn't true. Elephants are, and always have been, the king of the bush. They're massive and scary, truly dominant. In the hundreds of times I watched an elephant approach lions, the lions always backed off. But if the guide was right, I knew it was something I had to see for myself. The thought of it became something of an obsession. And again, with Andrew gone, I thought, why not?
He took a swallow of wine before going on. When I started working there, I learned that none of the guides had ever seen it, but they all believed it too.
because every now and then a carcass would turn up. If it was happening, it was incredibly rare, which made sense. Even if a pride of lions could take down an elephant, they would undoubtedly prefer easier prey. And during my first few years there, that's all I ever saw. The main source of food for the pride was what I'd always seen in the past. Impalas, warthogs, zebras, and giraffes. I never encountered a single elephant carcass. Halfway through my third year there, though, a drought set in. A bad one. It lasted months, and a lot of the regular game either died off or began migrating toward the Okavango Delta. Meanwhile, the lions were still around and gradually grew more desperate. Then, late one afternoon, while on a game drive, I saw it happen.
You did?
He nodded, retreating into the past. She watched as he swirled his wine glass before going on. It was a smaller elephant, not one of the big bulls, but the lion separated it from the herd and went to work. One at a time, almost like a military operation. One of them attacking the leg, another jumping on the elephant's back, while the other surrounded it, just sort of wearing the elephant down over time. It wasn't violent either. It was very calm, very methodical. The pride was cautious, and the entire attack probably took 30 minutes. And then, when the elephant was weakening, they ganged up, several attacking at once. The elephant went down, and it didn't take long after that. He shrugged, his voice growing softer. I know you might feel bad for the elephant, but by the end, I was awed by the lions. It was certainly one of the most memorable experiences of my guiding career.
Unbelievable, she said. Were you alone when it happened?
No, he said. There were six guests in the jeep. I think one of them ended up selling the video footage he took to CNN. I never saw it, but over the next few years, I heard from a lot of people who did. The lodge where I was working became very popular for a while after that. But eventually the rains resumed, and the drought ended. The game returned, and the lions went back to easier prey. I never saw it happen again, nor did I see another carcass. I heard that there was another occurrence some years later, but by then I was no longer there. She smiled. I'll say the same thing to you that I did when we first met. You definitely have the most interesting job of anyone I've ever known. It had its moments, he shrugged. She cocked her head. And you mentioned that Andrew went to Oxford? True nodded. He certainly ended up being a better student than I ever was. Incredibly bright. He excelled in science. You must be proud. I am. But truly, it had more to do with him. And Kim, of course, than me.
How's she doing?
Is she still married? She is. Her other children are grown now, too. Ironically, she actually lives near me again. After I settled in Bantry Bay, she and her husband moved to Cape Town. I've heard it's beautiful there. It is. The coastline is gorgeous. Beautiful sunsets. She stared into her glass. I can't tell you how many times I found myself wondering about you over the years. How you spent your days, what you saw, how Andrew was doing. For a long time, my life wasn't all that different from the life I had led before. It was mostly centered on work and Andrew. I went on two, sometimes three game drives a day, played my guitar or made sketches in the evening when I was in the bush. And in Bulawayo, I watched my son grow up. Saw him become interested in model trains for a year, then skateboards, then the electric guitar, then chemistry, and then girls, in that order. She nodded, remembering the phases Jacob and Rachel had gone through. How were his teenage years? Like most teens, he had his own social life by then. Friends, a girlfriend for a year. There was a period there when I felt a bit like a hotelier whenever he was around, but I recognized his desire for independence and accepted it more than Kim did. It was harder for her to let go of the little boy he once had been, I think.
It was the same with me, Hope admitted. I think it's a mother thing.
I suppose the most difficult time for me was when he went off to university. He was a long way from home, and I couldn't visit often, nor did he want me to. So I'd see him over the holidays or between terms, but it wasn't the same, especially whenever I returned from the bush. I felt restless in Bulawayo. I wasn't sure what to do with myself. So when I heard the rumor about the lions, I just picked up and left for Botswana.
Did Andrew visit you there?
He did, but not as frequently. I sometimes think I shouldn't have sold the house in Bulawayo. He didn't know anyone in Gaborone. I had an apartment there. And when he was on break, he wanted to see his friends. Of course, Kim wanted time with him too. Sometimes I would return to Bulawayo and stay in a hotel, but that wasn't the same either. He was an adult by then, a young one, but I could see he was beginning his own life.
What did he study?
He ended up taking a first in chemistry and talked about becoming an engineer. But after he graduated, he became interested in precious gems, especially colored diamonds. He's a diamond broker now, which means he travels to New York City and Beijing regularly. He was a good lad who turned into a fine young man.
I'd like to meet him one day.
I'd like that too, he said.
Does he ever go back to Zimbabwe?
Not often, nor do Kim or I. Zimbabwe is experiencing some difficult times.
I read about the land confiscation. Did that affect your family farm?
True nodded. It did. You should understand that there's been a long history of wrongs committed in that country by people like my grandfather. Even so, the transition was brutal. My stepfather knew a lot of people in the government, and because of that, he thought that he would be protected. But one morning, a group of soldiers and government officials showed up and surrounded the property. The officials had legal documents stating that the farm had been seized, along with all of its assets. Everything. My stepfather and half-brothers were given 20 minutes to gather their personal things and were escorted off the property at gunpoint. A few of our workers protested, and they were shot on the spot. And just like that, the farm and all the land was no longer theirs. There was nothing they could do. That was in 2002. I was in Botswana by then, and I was told that my stepfather went downhill pretty quickly. He started drinking heavily, and he committed suicide about a year later. She thought back to True's family history. It felt epic and dark, almost Shakespearean.
That's terrible.
It was, and still is, even for the people who received the land. They didn't know what to do with it, didn't know how to maintain the equipment or the irrigation methods, and they didn't rotate the crops correctly. Now nothing is being grown at all. Our farm turned into a squatter's camp, and the same thing has happened all over the country. Add in the currency collapse and... When he trailed off, Hope tried to imagine it.
It sounds like you got out just in time.
It makes me sad, though. Zimbabwe will always be my home.
What about your half-brothers?
True drained his glass and set it on the table. Both are in Tanzania. Both are farming again. But it's nothing like it was before. They don't have much land, and what they do have isn't nearly as fertile as the old farm. But the only reason I know that is because they had to borrow money from me, and they're not always able to make the payments.
That was kind of you. To help them, I mean.
They had no more ability to choose the family they were born into than I did. Beyond that, though, I think it's what my mum would have wanted me to do.
What about your biological father? Did you ever see him again?
No, True said. We spoke on the phone a couple of weeks after I returned to Zimbabwe, but he passed away not long after that.
How about his other children? Did you ever change your mind about meeting them?
No, True answered. And I'm fairly sure they didn't want to get to know me either. The letter from the attorney informing me of my father's death made that clear. I don't know their reasons, Maybe it was because I was a reminder that their mother wasn't the only woman our father loved. Or maybe they were worried about an inheritance. But I saw no reason to ignore their wishes. Like my father, they were strangers. I'm still glad you had a chance to meet him. He turned his gaze toward the fire. I am too. I still have the photographs and drawings he gave me. It seems like so long ago, he said. It has been a long time, she said quietly. Too long, he said, taking her hand, and she knew that he was talking about her. She felt her cheeks flush, even as his thumb began to caress her skin, his touch achingly familiar. How was it possible that they'd found each other again? And what was happening to them now? He seemed unchanged from the man she'd once fallen for, but it made her think again how different her own life had become. Where he was as handsome as ever, she felt her age. Where he seemed at ease in her presence, his touch triggered another wave of emotion. It was overwhelming, almost too much, and she squeezed his hand before releasing it. She wasn't ready for that much intimacy yet, but she gave an encouraging smile before sitting up straight. So, let me see if I have this straight. You were in Hwange until 1999 or 2000, and then you moved to Botswana? He nodded. 1999. I was in Botswana for 5 years. And then? I think for that, I'll probably need another glass of wine. Let me get it. Taking his glass, she retreated to the kitchen before returning a minute later. She got comfortable beneath the blanket again, thinking the room was warming up nicely. Cozy. In many ways, it had already been a perfect afternoon. All right, she said. What year was this? 2004. What happened? I was in an accident, he said. A rather bad one. How bad? He took a sip of wine, his eyes on hers. I died.
Dying. As he lay in the ditch by the side of the highway, Chu could feel his life slipping away. He was only dimly aware of his overturned truck, with a demolished front end, and of the way one of the tires was finally rotating to a stop. He barely noticed the people rushing toward him. He wasn't sure where he was, what had happened, why the world seemed blurry. He didn't understand why he couldn't seem to move his legs, or what was causing the relentless waves of pain throughout his entire body. Nor, when he finally woke in a hospital he didn't recognize in an entirely different country, would he remember the accident at all. He remembered that he had been returning to the lodge, after spending a few days in Gaborone, but only learned later from the nurse that an oncoming supply truck in the opposite lane had suddenly crossed into the path of his pickup. True hadn't been wearing his seatbelt, and in the collision, he rocketed through the windshield, cracking his skull and landing 40 feet away, which caused 18 more bones to break, including both femurs, all the bones in his right arm, 3 vertebrae, and 5 ribs. He was loaded into a vegetable cart by strangers and rushed to a temporary NGO clinic that was offering vaccinations at a nearby village. It had neither the equipment, medicine, or supplies that True needed, nor was a doctor even present. The floor was dirt, and the room was filled with children who had learned to ignore the flies that swarmed over their faces and limbs. The nurse was from Sweden, young and overwhelmed, and had no idea what to do when True was rolled into the waiting room. But people expected her to do something, anything. So she moved toward the cart and checked for a pulse. There was nothing. She checked the carotid artery. Still nothing. She put her ear to True's mouth and checked for breathing. She heard and felt nothing, then raced toward her bag for a stethoscope. She placed it on his chest and listened carefully for the faintest murmur without hearing anything, before finally giving up. True was dead. The owner of the vegetable cart, asked that the body be placed elsewhere, so he could go back and retrieve his vegetables before they were all stolen. There was an argument about whether he should wait for the police, but the owner shouted the loudest, and his opinion carried the day. He and the father of one of the children lifted True's body from the cart. The bones clicked and made grinding noises as True was placed on the floor in the corner, and the nurse draped a blanket over his body. People made room for the corpse, but otherwise ignored it. The owner of the vegetable cart vanished back onto the street, and the nurse continued to administer injections. Sometime later, True coughed. He was brought to the hospital in Gaborone in the bed of someone's truck. From the village, it took more than an hour to get there. When he was admitted, there was little the emergency doctor thought he could do. It was a wonder True remained alive. His stretcher was left in a crowded hallway, while the hospital staff waited for him to die. Maybe minutes, they thought. No more than half an hour. By then, the sun was going down. True didn't die. He survived overnight, but soon an infection set in. The hospital was short on antibiotics and didn't want to waste them. True's fever rose and his brain began to swell. 2 days passed, then three, and still he lingered somewhere between life and death. By then, Andrew had been contacted through his listing as next of kin on his ID, and had flown from England to be with his father. Alerted by Andrew, Kim also flew in from Johannesburg, where she was living at the time. An emergency medical flight was arranged, and True was flown to a trauma hospital in South Africa. He somehow survived that flight too, and was given massive infusions of antibiotics, while the doctors drained the fluid from his brain. He remained unconscious for 8 days. On day 9, his fever broke, and he woke to see Andrew by his bedside. He stayed in the hospital for 7 more weeks, while one by one his bones were reset, casted, and healed. Afterward, unable to walk, fighting double vision, and constantly plagued by vertigo, he was moved to a rehabilitation facility. He was there for nearly 3 years. At the cottage, the firelight flickered in Hope's eyes like candles, and True thought again that she was as beautiful as she'd been so long ago. Maybe more so. In the soft lines near her eyes, he saw wisdom and hard-won serenity. Her face was full of grace. He knew the years hadn't been easy for her. Though she hadn't spoken much about her marriage to Josh, he guessed she was avoiding the subject to spare not only True's feelings, but her own. Meanwhile, she stared at him, as though she was seeing him for the first time. "Oh my God," she said. "That's one of the most terrible things I've ever heard. How did you survive?"
"I don't know."
"Were you really dead?"
"That's what I was told. I called the nurse at the vaccination clinic about a year after the accident, and she swore that I had no vitals at all. She said that when I coughed, half of the patients in the room screamed. It made me laugh at the time."
"You're trying to be funny, but there's nothing funny about any of that."
"No," he agreed. "There wasn't." He touched his temple where his hair had turned white. "I had a traumatic brain injury. Some pieces of my skull were driven into my brain, and for a long time the wiring was all messed up. After I finally woke, I would talk to Andrew or the doctors, thinking that I was saying one thing, but actually I was saying something entirely different. I'd think I was saying, 'Good morning,' and what the doctors would hear was, 'Plums cry on boats.' It was incredibly frustrating. And because my right arm was so smashed up, I couldn't write either. Eventually, some of the wiring started to get straightened out. It was slow going, but even when I could speak and made sense, there were ridiculous gaps in my memory. I'd forget words, usually the simple things. I'd have to say, that thing you use to eat, the pokey silver thing you hold in your hand, instead of fork. While that was occurring, the doctors also weren't sure whether my paralysis was temporary or permanent. There was a lot of lingering swelling in my spine because of the broken vertebrae, and even after they put in rods, it took a long time for the swelling to go down.
Oh, true. I wish I would have known, she said, her voice beginning to crack.
There was nothing you could have done, he pointed out.
Still, she said, drawing her knees up under the blanket. That's when I was trying to find you. I never thought to check the hospitals.
He nodded. I know.
I wish I could have been there for you.
I wasn't alone, he said. Andrew would come to visit whenever he had the chance. Kim visited from time to time as well. And Romy somehow learned what had happened. It took him 5 days on a bus to reach the rehabilitation center, but he stayed for a week. All their visits were hard for me, though, especially during the first year. I was in a lot of pain. I couldn't really communicate, and I knew they were as frightened as I was. I knew they had the same questions I did. Would I ever walk again? Would I be able to speak normally? Would I ever be able to live on my own? It was hard enough already, without feeling their worries too.
How long was it until you started getting better?
The double vision improved within a month, but everything was still miserably out of focus for maybe 6 months after that. I was able to sit up in bed after 3 or 4 months. Movement in my toes came next, but some of the bones in my legs hadn't been set properly, so they had to re-break and reset them. Then there were the brain surgeries, and the spinal surgery, and it was an experience I'd rather not repeat.
When did you realize that you'd be able to walk again?
Moving my toes was a good start, but it seemed to take forever to be able to move my feet. And walking was out of the question, at least in the beginning. I had to learn how to stand again, but the muscles in my legs had atrophied, and my nerves still weren't firing correctly. I'd experience intense shooting pains all the way down the sciatic nerve. Sometimes I'd take a supported step, with bars on either side of me, but then I suddenly wouldn't be able to move my rear leg at all. Like the connection between my brain and my legs had suddenly been severed. Sometime around the year mark, I was finally able to cross the room with support. It was only 10 feet or so, and my left foot dragged a bit, but I actually wept. It was the first time I began to see a light at the end of the tunnel. I knew that if I kept working at it, I might one day be able to leave the clinic.
That must have been nightmarish for you.
Actually, I have trouble remembering all of it. It feels so distant now. Those days and weeks and months and years sort of run together. She studied him. I would never have known any of this unless you told me.
You seem the same as you were back then. I noticed the limp, but it's so slight.
I have to stay active, which means I keep to a rather stringent exercise routine. I walk a lot. That helps with the pain.
Is there a lot of pain anymore?
Some, but the exercise makes a big difference.
It must have been really hard for Andrew to see you like that.
It's still hard for him to talk about how I looked when he saw me in the hospital in Botswana, or how worried he'd been on the flight, and while waiting for me to wake up at the hospital in South Africa. He remained by my side for the duration of my stay at the hospital. I will say that he and Kim kept their wits about them. Had they not made arrangements for a medical flight, I doubt I would have survived. But once I was in the rehabilitation facility, Andrew was always more optimistic than I was whenever he saw me. Because he only saw me once every 2 or 3 months, my improvement to him was proceeding in leaps and bounds. To me, obviously, it felt altogether different.
And you said you were there for 3 years.
In the last year, I no longer lived on site. I still had hours of therapy every day, but it felt as if I'd been released from jail. I'd gone outside only rarely in the first 2 years. If I never see another fluorescent tube again in my life, it'll still be too soon. I feel so bad for you.
Don't, he said. I'm doing well now. And believe it or not, I met some wonderful people. The physical therapist, the speech therapist, my doctors and nurses, they were outstanding. But it's a strange period to remember, because it sometimes feels as if I took a 3-year pause in actually living my life, which in a way I did, I suppose. She inhaled slowly, as though absorbing the warmth of the fire.
Then, you're a lot stronger than I probably would have been about the whole thing.
Not really. Don't think for a second that I was unfazed. I was on antidepressants for almost a year.
I think that's understandable, she said. You were traumatized in every way.
For a while, they both stared into the fire. Hope's feet snuggled close to his legs under the blanket. He had the feeling that she was still trying to make sense of the things he'd told her, and how close they'd come to losing each other forever. Here and now, the idea felt incomprehensible to him, a near miss too harrowing to grasp. But then again, everything about today was unfathomable. That they were sitting beside each other on the couch right now felt both surreal and wildly romantic, until True's stomach gave an audible growl.
Hope laughed. You must be starving.
She threw off the blanket.
I'm getting hungry too. Are you up for some chicken salad? Over some greens?
If you'd rather, I also have some salmon or shrimp.
A salad sounds perfect, he said.
She stood. I'll get it started.
Can I help?
True asked, stretching.
I really don't need much help, but I wouldn't mind the company.
Hope draped the blanket on the couch, and they carried their wine glasses into the kitchen. As Hope opened the refrigerator, he leaned against the counter, watching her. She pulled out romaine lettuce, cherry tomatoes, and sliced peppers of various colors, and he reflected on what she told him that afternoon. The disappointments she'd experienced hadn't hardened into either anger or bitterness, but rather acceptance that life seldom turns out the way that one imagines it will. She seemed to sense what he was thinking, because she smiled. Reaching into the drawer, she pulled out a small knife, then a cutting board.
Are you sure I can't help?
He asked. This won't take long at all. But how about you grab the plates and forks? They're in the cabinet by the sink. At her instruction, he placed the plates next to the cutting board and watched as she sliced the vegetables. Next, she tossed and dressed the salad in a bowl with a little lemon juice and olive oil before arranging 2 servings on the plates. Finally, she added a scoop of chicken salad to each. He'd imagined being in a kitchen with her 1,000 times in the last 24 years, just like this.
Voila!
It looks delicious, he said, following her to the table. After putting her plate down, she motioned toward the refrigerator.
Do you want some more wine? She asked.
No, thank you. 2 glasses is my limit these days.
I'm closer to 1, she said.
She reached for her fork.
Do you remember when we had dinner at Clancy's, and then went back and had a glass of wine at my parents' cottage?
How could I forget, he said. That was the night we first got to know each other. You took my breath away. She nodded, a hint of color staining her cheeks. She bent over her salad, and he did the same. True nodded at the carved box sitting on the table.
What's in there?
Memories, she said, a mysterious lilt in her voice. I'll show you later, but for now, let's keep talking about you. I think we're up to around 2007. What happened after you finished your rehabilitation? He hesitated, as though trying to figure out what to say.
I found a job in Namibia, guiding, well-kept lodge and huge reserve, with one of the largest concentrations of cheetahs on the continent. And Namibia is a beautiful country. The Skeleton Coast and Sossusvlei Desert are among the most otherworldly places on the planet. When I wasn't working or flying to Europe to see Andrew, I played the tourist, exploring whenever I could. I stayed at the camp until I retired and moved to Cape Town. Or rather, Bantry Bay. It's on the outskirts, right on the coast. I have a small place there with a spectacular view. And it's walking distance to cafes, bookstores, and the market. That suits me. Did you ever think about moving to Europe, to be closer to Andrew? He shook his head. I get up there from time to time, and work brings him to Cape Town regularly. If he could, he'd move to Cape Town, but Annette won't let him. Most of her family lives in Belgium, but Africa has a hold on him, the same way it does on me. Unless you were raised there, it's hard to understand. Her gaze was full of wonder. Your life sounds incredibly romantic to me. Aside from that awful 3-year period, I mean. I've lived the life I wanted. Mostly, anyway. He ran a hand through his hair. Did you ever think about getting married again? After your divorce? No, she answered. I didn't even feel like dating. I told myself that it was because of the kids, but... But what? Instead of answering, she shook her head. That's not important. Let's finish with you. Now that you're retired, how do you spend your days? I don't do much, but I do enjoy being able to walk without carrying a rifle. She smiled. Do you have hobbies? She rested her chin in her hand, striking a girlish pose as she fixed her attention on him. Aside from drawing and guitar? I visit a gym most mornings for an hour, and usually follow that with a long walk or a hike. I do a lot of reading, too. I've probably read more books in the last 3 years than I've read in the previous 63 combined. I haven't broken down and bought a computer yet, but Andrew keeps insisting that I need to catch up with the times. You don't have a computer? What would I do with it? He seemed genuinely bemused. I don't know. Read online newspapers, order something you need, email, stay connected to the world? Maybe one day. I still prefer reading a regular newspaper. I have everything I need. And there's no one I want to email. Do you know what Facebook is? I've heard of it, True conceded. As I mentioned, I do read the paper. I had a Facebook account for a few years, in case you wanted to contact me. He didn't respond right away. Instead, he watched her, wondering how much to say, knowing he wasn't ready to tell her everything just yet. I thought about trying to reach out, he finally offered. More times than you can imagine. But I didn't know if you were still married, or remarried, or whether you were interested in hearing from me. I didn't want to disrupt your life. And really, I don't know how well I would do with a computer anyway. Or with Facebook. What do you Americans say? Can't teach an old dog new tricks. He grinned. It was a big step for me to get a cell phone. But I only did that so Andrew could reach me when he needed to. You didn't have a cell phone? I never felt like I needed one until recently. There's no service in the bush. And besides, the only one who would ever call was Andrew. How about Kim? Don't you still speak with her? Not very often these days. Andrew's grown now, so there's not as much reason for us to speak. And you? Do you still speak with Josh? Sometimes, she said. Maybe too much? True's expression was quizzical. A few months ago, he suggested we try and make a go of it again. Him and me, I mean. That didn't interest you. Not in the slightest, she responded. And I was a bit shocked that he had the nerve to bring it up. Why? While they finished their salads, Hope shared more detail about Josh. His affairs and the divorce battles. His subsequent marriage and divorce. And the toll that life had taken on him. True listened, hearing only a trace of the anguish that all of Josh's actions must have caused her, and thinking to himself that Josh was a fool, that she was somehow able to forgive him
struck True as remarkable, but then it was just another thing he admired about her. They lingered at the kitchen table, filling in blanks and answering questions about each other's past. When they eventually brought their dishes to the sink, Hope turned on the radio, letting the music drift out of the kitchen as they wandered back to the couch. The fire was still burning, casting a yellow glow through the room. True watched as she took a seat and tucked the blanket around herself, thinking that he never wanted this day to end. Until he'd learned that Hope had placed a letter in Kindred's spirit, True had sometimes thought that he died twice, not just once in his lifetime. Upon his return to Zimbabwe in 1990, he'd spent time with Andrew, but he could remember feeling numb to the world, even as he played soccer or cooked or watched TV with his son. When he went back to the bush, working with the guests was a distraction, but he could never escape thoughts of her. When he would stop the jeep on game drives so the guests could photograph whatever animal they were seeing, he would sometimes imagine that she was in the front seat beside him, marveling at his world in the same way he continued to marvel at the world they'd briefly inhabited together. The evenings were hardest. He couldn't concentrate long enough to either draw or play the guitar, nor did he socialize with the other guides. Instead, he would lie in bed and stare at the ceiling. Eventually, his friend Romy grew concerned enough to mention it, but it was a long time before True could even bring himself to say Hope's name. It took months for True to return to his normal habits, but even then, he knew he was no longer fully himself. Prior to meeting Hope, he dated occasionally. Afterward, he'd lost all desire to do so. Nor did that feeling ever change. It was as though that part of him, the desire for female companionship, or the spark of human attraction, had been left behind on the sandy shores of Sunset Beach, North Carolina. It was Andrew who finally got him drawing again. During one of True's visits to Bulawayo, his son asked whether True was angry with him. When True squatted low and asked why he would ever think such a thing, Andrew mumbled that he hadn't received a drawing in months. True promised to start sketching again. But on most evenings, when he put pencil to paper, it was Hope he sketched. Usually he recreated from memory something from their time together. The sight of her staring at him as he held Scotty that first day on the beach. Or how ravishing she'd looked on the night of the rehearsal dinner. Only after he'd made good progress in a drawing of Hope, would he turn his attention to something he suspected Andrew would like. The drawings of Hope took weeks to complete, not days. There was a newfound desire within him to match them perfectly with his memories, to capture those images with precision and care. When he was finally satisfied, he would save the drawing and start on the next. Over the years, the project became something of a compulsion, feeding an unconscious belief, perhaps, that recreating Hope's likeness perfectly would somehow bring her back to him. He made more than 50 detailed sketches, each of them documenting a different memory. When he was finished, he put them in order, a chronicle of their time together. At that point, he started to draw the corresponding sketches of himself, or how he imagined he'd looked to her in those same moments. In the end, he had them bound in a book, drawings of himself on the left-hand pages and Hope on the right, but he had never shown it to anyone. He'd finished it in the year after Andrew went to college. It had taken nearly 9 years to complete. That was another reason he lost much of his sense of purpose as the century wound down. He paced the house with nothing to do, leafed through the book every night, and dwelt on the fact that everyone who mattered in his life was gone. His mother, his grandfather, Kim, and now Andrew. Hope. He was alone, he thought, and would always be alone. It was a hard time, maybe as hard as his recovery from the accident would later be, but in a different way. Botswana and the Lion Quest,
as he referred to it then, had been good for him, but always he kept the book of sketches at hand, among his most vital possessions. After the accident, the book was the only thing he really wanted, but he didn't want to ask Andrew to bring it. He had never told Andrew about it, and he didn't want to lie to him or Kim. Instead, he had his ex-wife make arrangements to box up all of his things in Botswana and place them in storage. She did, but he spent much of the next 2 years worrying that the book had somehow been lost or damaged. The first thing that he did after moving out of the rehab facility was make a short trip to Botswana. He hired some youths to help him open box after box until the book was found. Aside from being dusty, it was in perfect condition. But the compulsion to relive in images the days that they'd shared together began to dim not long after that. For his own good, he knew he couldn't keep dreaming that they would someday be together again. He had no idea that around that time, hope had been trying to find him. Had he known, and despite his lingering injuries, he told himself he would have moved heaven and earth to go to her. And there'd been a moment when he'd come close to doing exactly that.